and nothing should be dictated from the outside.
Putin added that all sides have called for the continuation of the fight against terrorism and extremism so that such threats will be eliminated. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, while echoing the remarks made by his counterparts, also pointed out the importance of finding a sustainable political solution to the Syrian situation.
The city of Severodonetsk lies mostly in ruins. It was the scene of some of the fiercest fighting between the two armies. It now resembles a post-apocalyptic wasteland. At a military base, a pro-Russian fighter pulls down a Ukrainian sign. What's left of the city is now in Russian hands. On the outskirts of town, a grain silo. Russia and Ukraine blame each other for bombing it. Now, that may well be one of the most tragic places that I've been to in this war, because millions of people around the world may well go hungry due to this conflict because of the huge amounts of grain that Ukraine exports in usual times around the world. For those people, it won't really matter whether it was Russia or Ukraine who committed this strike. Humanity is bombing its own food supplies. Unsurprisingly, few people remain in the city. Those that do are keen to tell of what they saw.
The Ukrainians knew where people lived. They drove around looking for people's houses. And when they fled, they occupied their houses and started firing. We live in that house, and they were firing from there for 3 weeks.
It wasn't all done by Russia. It was done by Ukraine. There are witnesses who saw tanks driving up and firing at houses, just like that.
While NATO and Ukraine blame Russia for the devastation, the strange truth is that everyone I spoke to here is more critical of Ukraine.
Ukraine acted in a sly way. They would bring a howitzer here, fire, and then leave. Then Russia would strike, and they would say Russia is bombing civilians. They were occupying kindergartens and would fire from there.
They made them sit in the basement and took over their flats. They put mortars on the roofs and fired. We don't know what Russia did. We didn't see them until we returned.
While Russia and Ukraine continue to blame each other for the devastation wrought by this conflict, there remains little appetite for peace. The longer this war goes on, the more of Ukraine will be destroyed, and the greater the threat to world food supplies and the global economy. Johnny Miller, Severodonetsk.
EU foreign affairs ministers held their last scheduled meeting on Monday before taking a six-week summer break. Of course, proceedings were dominated by the war in Ukraine.
Ukraine needs more arms. We will provide them. The war will continue. We'll continue supporting. And that's why I have proposed the next tranche of the European Peace Facility, allocating 500 million more.
Josep Borrell has doubled down on criticism of sanctions against Russia and their impact on EU citizens. He has even written a blog on the subject. It's reported he's doing this because of growing disquiet amongst EU leaders regarding the harm sanctions are causing. Energy and food prices continue to rise in the EU, placing enormous pressure on citizens. Experts warn things could get worse.
We have seen over the last couple of months that there is disparity, there is disunity. There is already an exception for Hungary in terms of energy supply. And my worry is that as soon as the winter sets in, there might be a problem, and then we have to see how long the support for the sanctions will materialise.
Ordinary citizens are asking why we don't hear more about peace negotiations.
The price you pay now is out of control. Gas, oil, electricity, food. It's all gone crazy. We need to end the war.
As the West continues to pump billions of euro and dollars into Ukraine, the country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is sacking senior officials. Analysts say it shows the country remains corrupt at the highest levels. The European Commission will unveil much-anticipated plans on Wednesday designed to ensure the EU doesn't run out of gas this winter. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
¶¶
The British capital is boiling with July temperatures rarely seen in the country. For some, it's business as usual, a chance to bask in it. For others, a cause for concern.
I would say climate changing. Every year, it's just getting hotter and hotter. In other countries like Dubai and Kuwait, that's 50, 60 degrees. That's normal nowadays.
Basically, we let it go like downhill for like 200 years, for example. And now we just, we're doing something wrong here, you know. But at least the realization is a first step. So hopefully they will take it more serious and start actually doing something.
With temperatures climbing up to 41 degrees Celsius over the next 2 days, the National Meteorological Service has issued its first ever red warning for exceptional heat for much of the country.
Britain is a country where people are used to complaining about the wet weather. Now this scorching heat is going to give them something else to gripe about. But it doesn't stop there. There's real concern about how these rising temperatures will impact the everyday life.
Metro passengers have been urged not to travel by train. Schools are only allowing early pickups after the government said they had to stay open and that people should be resilient enough to enjoy the sunshine. Climate activists are threatening more decisive action to perceived inaction by government and big business, similar to the Extinction Rebellion protest that shut down parts of central London a few years ago. The activists' frustration now confirmed by the UK's climate minister, Alok Sharma, who has accused some of the candidates running for prime minister of being lukewarm on achieving the country's net zero target. And this week, his plea for climate action as he addressed the Petersburg Climate Dialogue in Berlin.
I have to say, and I say this with all sincerity, that many of the commitments that we heard in Glasgow remain just that. They are still just words on a page. And you know, because you can see this around you, all the evidence tells us that time is running out.
Climate scientists say the next decade will be defined by greater weather extremes. But the fear is it'll also be shaped by humanity's collective failure to do more. Syed Purizza, London.
Mashhad, a tourist magnet in northeast Iran. Every year, some 30 million pilgrims from across the Muslim world travel to Mashhad to visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam. But a few miles away from the shrine, there's a whole new world for tourists who would also like to enjoy natural resorts after a spiritual journey. Welcome to Kuh Sangi, a heaven at the heart of Mashhad, as described by this Iraqi family.
We come from Iraq. We visited the holy shrine of Imam Reza, and then I found about this amazing place called Kuh Sangi and came with my family to enjoy the scenery.
It's my second trip to Mashhad. The city offers you a whole traveling package that includes pilgrimage and recreation.
Kuh Sangi is one of a myriad of attractions in Mashhad. Natural resorts such as Shandi's and Chali Dara Valley, and recreational centers such as Water Waves Land and Iram Amusement Park are among the must-see places in Mashhad. The city is also home to 10,000 historical sites. Only 1,500 of those sites have so far been registered and developed for tourists.
One of the major attractions of Mashhad is its restaurants and street eateries. Mashhad is the city of foods. It has numerous restaurants serving a variety of local and international foods. Mashhad also has more than 680 parks, providing a chance for visitors to entertain themselves besides their pilgrimage.
Mashhad is also a hotspot for health tourism in the region. Only in 2021, over 24,000 health tourists visited the city, mainly from Iraq and Oman, earning the city roughly $48 million. Authorities in Mashhad say the potentials are countless, but so are the challenges. To foreign visitors, Mashhad is still a religious-only city, and many are not aware of its recreational capacities.
We at the municipality are trying to raise awareness of the attractions in Mashhad. One of those efforts is the launching of the English version of our website, which guides foreign travelers through the city online. We will soon launch the Arabic webpage as well.
Due to the large number of visitors throughout the year, Mashhad has one of the best-equipped public transport systems in the country. It has a growing subway network and bus rapid transit system, beside other transportation services, making it easy to access the desired tourist destinations in the city.
Known as the spiritual capital of Iran, Mashhad seems to offer more than a spiritual experience to visitors. With its spectacular natural resorts and growing number of recreational centers, Mashhad municipality plans to turn the city into a tourist hub in the region. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Mashhad.
Yet another wave of COVID-19 is hitting South Korea, with cases doubling to 40,000 per day in the past week. The BA5 Omicron subvariant accounts for almost a third of the new cases, a portion that is increasing. While experts recognize vaccines may not always prevent infection, they decrease illnesses and deaths.
Even people who have been infected with Omicron before are not able to develop enough immunity to this variant unless they are vaccinated. People who have been fully vaccinated and boosted but become infected have reduced chances of severe illness of 70 to 90%.
The fatality rate of COVID-19 has dropped to near the seasonal flu. Still, experts argue the changed behaviors of mask wearing and routine vaccinations should remain in place.
The recent spike in COVID-19 cases here comes as South Korea Thursday detects the first case of BA2.75, nicknamed Centaurus. Scientists worry this highly mutated Omicron variant is even more transmissible than previous strains.
Some want stronger antivirus enforcement, suggesting public apathy risks another COVID-induced economic downturn. People are required to wear masks on transit, but the government has said it will not implement lockdowns. People over 50 will be offered fourth vaccinations next week. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that 22% of people in the EU are struggling to make ends meet. That's almost 100 million citizens who are counting every cent. Apparently, sending weapons to Ukraine is not the answer.
The best way to deal with the cost of living crisis is to stop prolonging the war. The people of Europe favour peace, even well above punishing Russia.
EU financial markets are in turmoil. There are calls for the introduction of a windfall tax.
Energy prices and food prices are going through the roof. Capitalists make profits by speculating on markets and thereby hurting millions of households.
Members of the public have been talking to us about the current state of the EU's economy.
It's terrifying to see that our free market is like collapsing. All the money that we are going to send to Ukraine, then we will have to need this money, and where we are going to take this money from.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has been singled out for criticism in the European Parliament.
We turn now about the increase of cost of living in the European Union, which is just a result of the insane and unsound policies promoted by the European Union since Ursula von der Leyen took office.
There have been calls for greater solidarity between EU member states to deal with the cost of living crisis.
In order to make sure that we are not at the end dividing Europe in those who are able to help and those who have more difficulties.
On sanctions against Russia, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has said, quote, "Initially I thought that we had only shot ourselves in the foot, but now it is clear that the EU economy has shot itself in the lungs and is gasping for air." Many here agree. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
This one lay. This one lay. This one lay. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran has hosted the presidents of Turkey and Russia for the Astana process for Syria, which the Syrian foreign minister was then hosted by Iran a day later. One of the issues which was discussed, Turkey's possible military operation in northern Syria. Iran has voiced concern, with Iran's leader advising Turkey's presidents not to launch a new military operation. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether Turkey will go ahead with this or not, and look at Syria's security situation, possible cooperation with Iran and Russia on combating terrorism, why Turkey has said that the U.S. feeds terrorist organizations and must leave east of the Euphrates in Syria. Our guests for this edition of The Spotlight are Jim Kavanaugh joins us. He's a founder of the Polemicist.net, joins us from New York. Also joining us is Tony Gosling, who's an investigative journalist, joining us from Bristol over in the U.K.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
To you both. Tony Gosling, really, first start with you. You have the Iranian foreign minister who has expressed concern regarding this potential Turkish, some call it an invasion, some call it a military operation in Syria, northern part of that country, which Ankara might undertake under the pretext of fighting terrorists, of which it has said that it will do. How concerning is this situation in which Turkey wants to possibly go through with it? At this point, anyways.
Well, look, before I answer that question, I think it's important to point out that these are real talks going on, because I think what many countries have now realised, particularly those involved in these Middle East conflicts, is that in order to actually make any progress, the British and the Americans, and to a large extent, the European Union, have to be out of the room, because there really has been no progress in talks almost whatsoever with any of these power blocks who, I mean, to be frank with you, the British Empire went at the end of the Second World War. The Americans tried to take over, but they still cannot actually face the fact that the empire is crumbling, and everything that they're doing is in an attempt to re-establish or to stop these empire aims from disappearing. So, you've got to have the Americans out of the room if you're going to make any progress. So that's the reasons why we've got these three powers, even though, of course, Turkey is a NATO power, sitting down to have real conversations and real talks about how each of those countries, each of those factions, what happens in these situations? This is a bit of horse trading. The Turks will be saying, well, we want this, we want that. And the Russians will be saying, et cetera. And all the various parties will be having their say on Syria. And at the end of the talks, what we may well find is that some compromises have been made during those talks. Now, coming to your question, So at least we've got that as a prospect, which we, when you're in talks with the British and the Americans, that's very, very rarely the case. The diplomatic aspect of it is basically out of the door. The diplomats' hands are tied. I think, you know, there will be some sort of progress on this, I would imagine, particularly because the Russians are in the room. Obviously, the Russians have got a big stake in Syria. Russia was largely the reason why the US empire failed in its attempt to overthrow President Assad. Main reason for that being the Tartus port, which is so crucial to projecting Russian military stabilizing power in the Mediterranean. Of course, we can't have a Mediterranean which is dominated by the Sixth Fleet and by NATO. That would be a disaster for many of the countries which rely on the balance of power being maintained in that part of the world. There's also the absolutely extraordinary situation of turning back ISIS and these proxy forces, mercenaries paid by the West and by NATO. Some Diliana Gatasheva, the investigative journalist, has proven that the arms that were going to ISIS were coming from the United States. They were just using fake end-use certificates. So this was an amazing success, really, in stopping the regime change in Syria over the last decade or so. Very, very concerted attempt by the Americans. And it's actually, in a way, it's comparable to something like the Battle of Stalingrad in the Second World War, where the Russians turned back the assault on their country, the Soviet Union, by the Nazis. Or even if you go back further to biblical times, you know, Paul's conversion from the Saul in Acts 9 in the Bible, on the road to Damascus, this massive conversion and this complete change in this individual who was persecuting the early Christians and turned around and then became one of their biggest advocates and, of course, wrote large parts of the New Testament after it. So it was an enormous, enormous turnaround in Syria. And so it's absolutely right to keep those people who were trying to institute regime change in Syria out of this and to slowly bring the Turks on side, I suppose, prize them away from the NATO alliance and to bring about some peace here through some real horse trading with these three main powers.
Sure. Well, Jim Kavanaugh, our guest there has opened up a topic there that is worth asking you then, the question of which, in the format of the Astana process, you have the Russian president, you have the Turkish president, and obviously the Iranian president, Iran being the host, of which you're having a diplomacy work there in terms of working out things wherein if you did have the U.S. or the British in the room, that things would not be at all going in a direction where there'd be any type of result. And maybe at the same time, in the same breath, I may ask you if you make a comparison to the way that the U.S. president visited West Asia or Middle East, as they call it, and not coming out with anything. At least here, you're having some tangible progress. You're having these leaders, presidents meet Iran's leader. You're having an exchange of thoughts, and you're reaching some kind of direction as to where things may go. Is it appropriate to view it that way? Of course, I'd like to thank Tony Gosling for that perspective.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree that it's much more likely to be productive without the Americans and the British in the room. And, you know, you have the principals in this case, who are all serious people, and none of them are the kinds of poodles that the Europeans are to American imperialism. And so that's an important issue, and that opens up a possibility. What you do have is, first of all, let's make clear the Americans are still in the background on this. The Americans occupy a third of Syrian territory. They occupy oil fields and grain and agricultural fields that are very important, and they haven't given up on their regime change target yet. But you know, clearly that's not going to happen probably. And what they have been doing is preventing Syria from reconstructing, and they're going to continue to do that as long as they can. On the other hand, in terms of the principles in Astana, you have Erdogan, who is a smart cookie, and he works for himself. And he plays all sides, and look what he just did with NATO. You know, so he is going to, and he has, you know, on the backs of the Americans, and he came in and occupied part of Syrian territory. He's not going to give that up easily. Syria at some point, and the Russians, backed by the Russians, are going to have to decide what they're going to do about the American occupation, what they're going to do about the Turkish occupation. Now, as you know, Tony said, this kind of negotiation with these principals might come to some conclusion on that. But everybody now, I'm very suspicious because, you know, look at what Erdogan has done with NATO. With all the attention and all the cats away in Ukraine, you know, the mice can play in Syria. And it, I don't know what Erdogan is going to insist on or what Assad is going to insist on. He wants his territory back. He should have it. And what would he give to get Turkey out of it? What would Turkey take to get out of his territory? It's a tricky situation, but it's one which is kind of, for the moment, with the Astana process, has some possibilities of resolution because it's put the imperial masters to the side, at least for the moment and directly.
Well, it looks like there's a common goal here, Tony Gosselin. Correct me if I'm wrong. When you have Turkey that, even after meeting Iran's leader who said that, you know, this military incursion that you're going to make or take is not a good idea, it's actually going to help the terrorists and it's going to create instability. Meanwhile, Turkey has said, you know what, I need you, Russia and Iran, to support this Turkish operation in Syria with the common goal that we want to eliminate terrorists. Now, Turkey views the YPG militia as terrorists, okay? So are we seeing that there may be some cooperation there in order to stop Turkey, as it has been stated, to want to carve out that slice of northern Syria when Russia and Iran will come into the picture and aid Turkey in terrorist operations, if Russia and Iran, that is, decide to do so?
Well, they may well do so. And I think this is the steely test of these diplomats. They're able at these talks to actually do their job, as diplomats are actually very well trained to do it. Their hands are totally tied if they're British diplomats or US diplomats. But I think there's every possibility that we will see some sort of deal come out of this. It benefits everybody to reduce tensions. It benefits the Turks, it benefits the Syrians, benefits the Russians and Iran. All powers in the region would be really happy to see less and less tension, the idea of sort of, you know, picking up arms, trying to grab more territory. And of course, one of the reasons that the Turks have been taking territory and the YPG have is as a bargaining chip. So this is where those bargaining chips come down on the casino table today. This is what they're there for. So they will be making concessions. I do believe that they're not simply there to steamroller through their views and ignore everybody else like the British and the Americans do in their talks. And in the background to this, we've got a much more confident Russia. Very important to see that the Russians now, I see Sergei Lavrov is now saying that the objectives in Ukraine are beyond the Donbass. So he's now, they've changed their tune a bit. They said they wanted to liberate the Donbass, and they're now saying, well, actually, it may be more than that. And of course, the Russians may not want more than that, but they're confident enough to say that they do want more than that in order to force Zelensky and the Ukrainians to the negotiating table. So that's the sort of thing the Russians, I think, are showing an example to the world here. What they're doing is they're saying, come to the table, come to the negotiating table. You know, the West, okay, the Americans, the British have refused to do that time and time again. I think with every possibility that we may see changed borders ultimately in Syria, a new lines drawn, but those negotiations are taking place now, and they're very real negotiations that may become... Let's not forget the actual Syrian people themselves. They want this over with. They want to return to a normal, peaceful life, and they may be able to get that if things go well at these talks.
Well, Jim Kavanaugh, so at least, you know, when it comes to Syria, we know what Russia wants, we know what Iran wants, and also we know the Turkish aim. Do we know what the U.S. wants? What is it doing in Syria?
Oh, it wants to keep, as I said, it wants to keep Syria from reconstruction. It wants to keep the Syrian government and society from unifying and from building itself up again. And it wants to keep Syria weak, you know, and it wanted to topple the government of Syria. It wanted to destroy the state. It didn't get away with that because the Russians intervened and interrupted it, although it's not over yet. And they are going to play the game. They're going to try and play Erdogan themselves in a certain way. I'm not as optimistic about Erdogan, and I don't know what the Turks want. I wouldn't say that. I think it would be on the table right away. The Russians and the Iranians will say to the Turks, oh, we'll keep down. We'll prevent the YPG from organizing and mobilizing and disarm them, etc. If you leave the territory, I don't know that Erdogan actually wants to leave. And I don't know that the Americans might be saying to Erdogan, you know, we might sit here and say, well, the Russians are showing their strength, but the Russians are also involved. They're occupied. They have things to do in Ukraine. And the Americans might be saying to the Turks, and Erdogan might be saying to himself, well, I can make moves now. And the Russians may not really want to get involved in something right here at this time while they're still not finished in Ukraine. So all of these variables are out there, and they make for a very interesting situation. And unfortunately, the victim in this is Syria, which is divided, which is occupied by various countries and various and we don't have a clear sense of how that's going to end in a way that restores the territorial integrity and the unity of Syria and allows it to rebuild in a strong way. Iran wants that. Russia wants that. I don't know that Erdogan wants that, and the Americans certainly don't.
Well, Tony Gosling, so this is what Erdogan has said. He came out and said the U.S. feeds terrorist organizations and must leave east of the Euphrates in Syria. Obviously, he's talking about the U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters. So, in a sense, why doesn't Turkey address this issue with the U.S. and for the U.S. to make up its mind if it is tiptoeing the line of whether it's going to support Turkey or it's going to support the Kurds that they used so much in the war against Syria?
Well, look, that's a great question, a really good question. And of course, what the answer to it is that the Americans are still using these terrorists as leverage in Turkey. Turkey's in a really unenviable position, being right in the middle of all of this between East and West, in the enormous tensions that there's been between the old Soviet, the Russians, and, well, they were Soviets, they're not anymore, the Russians and the West, including, of course, some of the ex-Soviet states in the West, and the Russian and American tensions in the Middle East. The Turks are right in the middle. And I think they are trying to play a game where they can play one off against each other. And I'm not sure that they're going to win that game. It seems pretty clear to me that, you know, you've got much, much bigger potential battles going on around the world. Just take a look at what's been happening in Taiwan, between China and the US. The US seems to want to pick a fight with everybody. And the Turks, I think, have really got to make their mind up which side they're on. Of course, there is an attempt to, you know, harden the sides in these big international conflicts. The military use that terminology when they're preparing for a war. They don't want independent states, certainly not big ones like Turkey. So they really need to try to get the Turks on board with their plans for the Middle East, and also, of course, their plans to fight in Ukraine, which the Turks have not been so enthusiastic about. So, you know, you've got to see this in the wider context of the enormous tensions with Taiwan, with the Americans sailing a destroyer down through the Taiwan Straits and really, really annoying the Chinese. Now, of course, the problem with what's been going on in Ukraine in the background is that this has given the Chinese confidence. The Chinese are looking at the Russians and saying, well, if Russia could do this in the Donbass, maybe we can do this in Taiwan. And that could potentially be disastrous. You know, the Americans have said anything that happens in Taiwan, we're going to go all out to liberate it. So you've got the potential of a fuel of a much, much bigger, wider war between China and the US. I'm not saying this is going to happen, but I think we need to bear these things in mind when we're talking about these, what Syria is now, a minor conflict. And, you know, if there was a wider war, there would be a big focus, I think, on the core of that would be this tension between Israel and Iran. And that's why it's so important to get Syria straightened out and these nations in the Middle East much more stable. Otherwise, that becomes a powder keg for the sort of core of this potential World War III between Iran and Israel, which, you know, that I think would become, you know, a much, much bigger problem in the future. So I'm not trying to, prophesy here, predict the future, but I think we need to bear these much bigger plans that I believe the United States has, because they are not going to just release their empire just like that. They want to, I think, use their military power before they go down, and we need to try and keep them in the box. And that's exactly what the Russians, the Turks, and the Iranians are doing talking about Syria today. Very important, and it'd be nice to see much more going on the wider sphere between, you know, between the Americans and the Americans, the big players in Ukraine, talking to the Russians. We need to have these talks. Otherwise, we're going to see, you know, I think, you know, potentially wider conflicts taking place that will dwarf what happened in Syria, and we really don't want that.
Well, Jim Cavanaugh, I'm still trying to get an answer on as to why the U.S. is in Syria. You gave some explanations there. There are other sides to the story behind the U.S. presence. One of them is the fact that the U.S. is aiding and abetting terrorists. Russia has come out and said that in and around that area that they're in. And they're moving actually troops interchangeably between Syria and Iraq. Because Iran has said if the U.S. withdraws itself from that area, then there is going to be a move towards stability. Then there will be a move towards this calming down. So in that regards, how do you see that happening? I mean, what do you see as chances of that happening? Or are we still looking at a prolonged presence? Because, again, it goes back to the question, what is the U.S. gain here?
Oh, I think there's very little chance of that happening from the U.S. In terms of the U.S. presence. The United States is going to stay there as long as it can. Look, the reason the United States went into Syria and wants to disrupt Syria and destroy the Syrian state, it's the same reason it wanted to destroy Libya and Iraq. It's in the neocon program for destroying all the resistance states against Israel. And Syria was the stepping stone towards Iran. That was always the case. That was explicitly said. And it still is the case. So one of the things that, you know, we have to keep in mind is that not only Americans and the Turks, but the Israelis are bombing Syria every week, a couple of times a week. You know, there's a military attack going on in Syria. There's military occupation of the country and a military attack. And from the Obama administration, when they signed when Israel and the United States signed a secret agreement, essentially setting up a war council against Iran, that has been the program. So there's no question that the American game in Syria is part of the American game, the Israeli-driven American game against Iran. And we are in a situation, I think, you know, JCPOA negotiations are failing, and I think that we're in a situation, Israel wants an attack on Iran, and they want to create a situation in area in which that can happen. And they can get away with it, and they need the Americans to go along with it. So that's got to be put into this, into our thinking about this, because that is the reason the Americans went into Syria, and sure. You know, because Syria was not doing anything to the United States. They were cooperating with the United States in a lot of ways, but they were part of the resistance actions sure. against Israel.
That 9 years of it, Tony Gosling, 9 years of a war in Syria, 9 years of the U.S. and its allies trying to get rid of their obsession with Assad, it didn't work. So I'm not too sure what track record the U.S. has to even want to think about pursuing that goal. And at the same time, we're looking at a different Russia. Our guest there talks about how Israel attacks Syria every other week. Well, you know, at this point, Russia is sanctioned off by the West. Israel, by default, has now gone along with the West when it comes to Russia because, obviously, of what it's doing in Ukraine. So Russia has issued a few warnings to Israel about not attacking Syria. Are we looking at the possibility of the warnings turning into action by Russia when it comes to Israel attacking Syria?
Well, the obvious thing to do would be to shoot down an Israeli jet, wouldn't it? That's the obvious thing to do. That may happen. We shall see, particularly since the Russian S-400 system is pretty efficient at doing that kind of thing. So, you know, I think that could happen at any time. I agree with Jim as well that we just heard there that, you know, this is really about Israel. That's why the Americans are there. They're doing it for Israel. And they've got a rather frightening Christian Zionist faction in the United States, an enormous faction that believes that what the Israelis do is God's will. This is quite frightening with pastors like Hagee and others that believe that what Israel does is somehow, you know, this is always going to be the right thing, that they can do no wrong. Now, this is also a very worrying faction. That is to say, the twisting and misuse of the Christian and other religions in these conflicts. And that's why I think we need to be a very close eye
on
the Middle East and how various religions are being used in order to try and exacerbate Middle East conflicts.
Thank you. Sorry to jump in, Tony Gosling, fresh out of time, investigative journalist. Jim Kavanaugh, thank you, founder of the Polemicist.net. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tatway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The refusal of Arab countries in the region to join the United States in exerting pressure on Russia over Ukraine. The political conflicts between Moscow and Tel Aviv over the military presence of the Zionist regime in Syria. The emergence of new military and economic allies for Russia in the region. And the expansion of Moscow's trade ties with its neighboring countries shows that West Asia has been experiencing new changes for a long time. We now present you an article written by Samoneh Ekvan, a journalist and researcher with a PhD in international relations. The piece is titled, The US and the New Regional Order in West Asia. U.S. President Joe Biden began his first trip to West Asia as president, while the region is undergoing an unprecedented chain of fundamental and quick changes. The Russian special operation in Ukraine altered many world equations and the world order, but no one thought at the beginning of the Ukraine conflict that the first region whose order and security would undergo extensive changes would be West Asia. The Biden administration has repeatedly announced that West Asia is not among its priorities. Ukraine, China, and the midterm congressional elections in the United States are issues that exert more influence on his administration's decisions. However, the same issues, namely the U.S.-China relations, the conflict in Ukraine, and how to confront Russia eventually, pulled Biden back into West Asia so as to compel Saudi Arabia and other oil-rich countries in the region to increase their oil production, to resolve the energy security crisis in the world, and put an end to soaring prices in the United States and in Europe. The growing pressure on the Biden administration, including criticisms leveled at him for not resolving the energy crisis engulfing the U.S. through increasing domestic oil production, eventually convinced him to announce that the most important reason for his trip is not issues related to energy security, but rather the security issues of Washington's Arab allies and the Israeli regime. The trip was supposed to have a strong impact on regional security and order, yet a glimpse into the current processes and latest developments in the geopolitics of the region shows that Biden's move to forge an alliance between Arabs and the Zionist regime was a reaction to current changes rather than a creative move aimed at confronting Russia in the region. The issue is that West Asia had already been undergoing changes in terms of regional security and regional order long before Joe Biden decided to make his first trip to the region since taking office. The refusal of Arab countries in the region to join the United States in exerting pressure on Russia over Ukraine, the political conflicts between Moscow and Tel Aviv over the military presence of the Zionist regime in Syria, the emergence of new military and economic alliances for Russia in the region, and the expansion of Moscow's trade ties with neighboring countries shows that West Asia has been experiencing new changes for a long time. These changes, in terms of speed and timing, are potentially perilous for the United States and for Western countries. Russia's trade agreements with China and its other neighbors, the creation of a north-south corridor through Iran's route in the economic dimension, and the recognition of the independence of Donetsk and Luhansk by Syria and North Korea in the political dimension shows that Russia had a long time earlier launched its recruitment strategy in the region. But at that time, Biden was busy threatening Moscow with the membership of Sweden and Finland in NATO, as well as threatening Beijing to use the military in case of Taiwan. Before that, the disgraceful withdrawal of US from Afghanistan showed that the West Asia region is no longer important for the United States, but drastic changes cause heads to turn to this region once again. The reason as to why the Democratic administration in Washington realized too late the importance of the region in the field of international relations was because the Biden administration thought that the Arabs and the Zionist regimes getting closer to each other was a serious and burgeoning issue. However, analysts are of the opinion that this process is very slow and complicated due to widespread mistrust between the two sides, as well as among the Arab countries themselves. The announcement of the issue by Joe Biden and the Saudi media during his current trip to the region is by itself proof of this claim. The US administration was of the opinion that the Arabs and the Zionist regime getting closer to each other and creating a unified front against Iran, Tehran will eventually have to succumb to the US demands in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. And without economic benefits from the JCPOA, it would only be continuing the implementation of its obligations in the agreement. He believed that if pressures on Tehran worked, returning a small portion of the oil revenues to our country could solve the issue of regional rivalry forever and give the upper hand to the Zionist regime and its Arab allies. Nevertheless, the complication of the process of normalization of ties between the Arab countries of the region and the Zionist regime and the more active regional diplomacy of Iran that led to further and better economic relations between the countries of West Asia region and Iran, and even between Tehran, Beijing and Moscow, totally messed up the calculations of the White House about this region. In fact, it can be clearly stated that Russia's special operation in Ukraine, apart from changing the regional order in Eastern Europe and in Eurasia, showed its first consequences in West Asia, and hopelessly turned the United States' actions in the region towards aimless reactions or, at best, propaganda reactions. Oil prices jumped by several percentage points on Monday, 18th of July, after US President Joe Biden returned from his Saudi Arabia trip without getting firm assurances from Arab allies to boost crude oil supplies amid a severe shortage caused by sanctions on Russian oil. All major benchmarks were higher on Monday morning, with Brent crude, a benchmark for the purchase on global financial markets, rising more than 4 percentage points to $105 per barrel, bringing the prices back to above $100 a barrel after several months. On the second leg of his maiden trip to West Asia, Joe Biden joined leaders of several OPEC countries in the Saudi port city of Jeddah on Friday, 15th of July, for a summit, which was designed to lobby for a boost in oil production by the Persian Gulf periphery states in order to confront the turbulence in the global energy market. The US president, who vowed to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state during his election campaign in late 2020, was forced into a vault face amid a deeply worsening energy crisis after the US and its allies imposed unprecedented sanctions on Russia. In Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, Joe Biden was welcomed with a fist bump by Saudi de facto ruler and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who, according to an investigation by the top American spying agency, was the mastermind behind the dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi's murder. Dashing his hopes, the kingdom and its regional allies refused to entertain Biden's demands, forcing him to head back to Washington virtually empty-handed. Talking to reporters in Jeddah, Joe Biden mainly mentioned energy while describing his meeting with the Saudi Crown Prince, but stopped short of commenting on whether he had received a firm pledge from the Saudi leadership on boosting crude oil supplies. Thus, the main question now is whether the regional order in West Asia is disrupted, or is the region moving towards an order in which the United States no longer has a role in causing disruption? It seems that the second question is more worthy of consideration and can be scrutinized in many international relations issues in academic circles and think tanks in the West as well as the region itself.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.